I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bull of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me today in Las Vegas is Judge Deborah Westbrook, and in Carson City, who I can see on the screen over there, is Judge Michael Gibbons. While I do not anticipate any problems, because the court and counsel will be participating at two locations via Zoom, I would ask that everyone be mindful of this when asking questions and responding to them. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 88356 in the matter of Melton versus Lawson. At council table in Carson City, I believe we have Emily Ellis and Zachary Meyer on behalf of the appellant and Patrick O'Rourke on behalf of the respondent. Is that correct?
All right, Mr. Meyer just said that Emily Ellis is not here today, but Mr. Walther is sitting in.
Hey. I'm sorry, who's sitting in? I can barely hear you, Judge Gibbons.
Eric Walther.
Oh, okay, thank you very much. And I believe, Mr. Meyer, you will be arguing on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that right?
Yes, correct, sorry. Yeah.
He said yes, there's no microphone over at council table, so I'm sorry you could not hear him, Chief Judge Bullitt, but yes, he'll be arguing.
And, okay, thank you so much.
And at the other council table, I believe we have Mr. O'Rourke and his client here. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, that's correct.
All right, Mr. O'Rourke and also Ms. Lawson.
Thank you very much. And is there anyone else present at council table that has not yet been identified?
Okay, that's it. Two counsel at one table and one counsel and one client at the other table.
Thank you so much, Judge Gibbons.
And we have one other thing. Clerk of the court, Elizabeth Brown, is here. And there's somebody I can barely see seated next to her. Oh, we have IT, and we have Marshall too.
Well, it's always good to have IT present, so thank you all. Each party today is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Meyer, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I'll go with 2 minutes, Your Honor.
He said 2 minutes.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Meyer, if you're ready, you may proceed.
Can y'all hear me well?
Your Honors.
Just speak up since it's everybody's having a little trouble with the microphones.
Okay. Here, I'll just project. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Zachary Meyer, and I, along with my co-counsel, Eric Walther, represent the appellants in this matter, Catherine Melton, and the estate of Mary Melton, her mother. Your Honors, this is not a case in which a pro se litigant is asking for special treatment. It is a case in which a pro se litigant is asking that her pro se status not be held against her. Because the district court did exactly that when it overlooked the well-pleaded allegations in the complaint and failed to apply a case-concluding sanctions analysis when it dismissed the complaint with prejudice for litigation conduct, the district court's decision must be reversed. Today, I would like to address each of the aforementioned errors in turn, beginning with the district court's error in dismissing Ms. Melton's petition under Nevada's notice pleading standard.
Mr. Meyer, before you actually get into the substance, you indicated that Ms. Melton was the party individually and as the administrator of the estate. Is there actually an estate still open? Do you know?
Is the question, Your Honor, whether the probate proceedings are still pending?
Right.
I believe they're closed, Your Honor, but that's not reflected in the record.
Okay. Is the estate a proper party then here on the appeal?
To my knowledge, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
So looking to the 12b-5 standard, Your Honor, and while I want to note that all of Ms. Melton's claims are well pleaded, I'm going to focus on the undue influence claim as an example, but I'm happy to address any particular claim that Your Honors are interested in. So, turning to the claim for undue influence. To establish undue influence, it must appear either directly or by justifiable inference that the influence destroyed the agency of the testator. Furthermore, a presumption of undue influence applies if there is a fiduciary relationship and the fiduciary benefits. Now, I want to take a step back and note, Your Honor, that undue influence, that exact phrase, appears in multiple places throughout the complaint. So do the elements of undue influence, for example, in Volume 3 on page 12. My client was not required to present this information to satisfy the standard under the listing case, but she nevertheless did. The only thing the complaint is missing is perhaps headings, but it is very clear what is occurring in the complaint, and as a matter of fact, opposing counsel was able to identify four claims without problem, most likely because those claims are specifically identified throughout the complaint.
Mr. Meyer, I apologize for interrupting you, but I would like to start back a little bit from the beginning and follow up on a question that Judge Gibbons asked. This is a civil action, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So typically in Nevada, don't we commence a civil action by filing a complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
But in this case, a petition was filed, and I don't believe anyone's challenging that vehicle, are they?
No, Your Honor. But to Your Honor's... I'm
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, to Your Honor's point, I believe the district court acknowledged that this could have been called a petition or a complaint. The court uses interchangeable language in its order to talk about her as a petitioner and a plaintiff as well.
Now, let me follow up on this question then. Who is really the true party in this case? Because it's a survivor action. This claim was brought after Mary Melton, was deceased, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the only way you can recover in this case is by statute?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, no. My client's able to recover as the administrator of both Mary Melton's estate and in her individual capacity.
What does NRS 41.100 say about that?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, yes, that statute allows for her to recover as a survivor, as an individual, if I'm thinking of the correct statute. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe she also has standing to bring these claims just as an administrator of the state in general, the same way that it administers. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. But she does not have any of her own individual claims. All of her claims are being brought on behalf of the estate. She does not have an individual cause of action against Ms. Lawson, does she?
Yes, she does. So under the undue influence standard, Your Honor, she can bring it in her individual capacity. But you're correct with regard to the remainder of the claims that they have to be brought through the estate. For example, elder abuse would have had to have been brought through the estate. But to my knowledge, in looking at the case law, and I have a cite here for you, Your Honor, the estate of the Thurum case, it must appear either directly or by justifiable inference that the influence destroyed the agency of the testator. I believe that case addresses the issue where someone who is an heir has standing by virtue of inheriting the assets of the testator whose will is overcome. But other than that, you're correct, Your Honor. The remaining claims would have to be brought through the estate.
Is she actually an heir, Mr. Meyer?
She would be if the... yes, Your Honor, she is an heir. She would be inheriting the assets of Mary if the property was set aside or the transfers were set aside under the quitclaim deed, for example.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. So turning back to the allegations, Your Honor, that supports that Ms. Lawson's destroyed Mary's agency. So I want to give you an example from the complaint. Quote, within a week of Mary's son's death, Ms. Lawson exercised undue influence over the grieving Mary and proclaimed herself to be Mary's caretaker. She took advantage of her advanced age, declining mental and physical health, to turn her against her only living daughter with lies and deceit, constant yelling, and speaking badly of her. There are also allegations that Ms. Lawson socially isolated Mary, kept her from her family members, trespassed them when they attempted to come onto the property, changed Mary's phone number to keep them from her. There are allegations that she screamed at Mary, that she lied to and deceived Mary to create a false sense of urgency to make Mary transfer all of her assets to Ms. Lawson. There are also allegations that Ms. Lawson neglected Mary. She allowed her to eat non-diabetic food and even allowed her to contract gangrene disease and other diseases associated with neglect. And ultimately, Your Honors, according to the complaint, Mary lost the will to live because of these actions. And therefore, her will was overcome, and Ms. Lawson benefited from that. So turning to the allegations showing that she benefited, another example, Your Honors, quote, Ms. Lawson insisted that Mary's daughter and grandchildren deserved nothing and coerced her to sign a quitclaim deed, dual power of attorney, change her life insurance policy, and sign a living trust making Ms. Lawson the only heir to all of Mary's assets and add Ms. Lawson to her checking account. There are also allegations that establish a fiduciary relationship and therefore a presumption of undue influence. For example, Mary and Ms. Lawson's, quote, relationship alone gave rise to a presumption of undue influence. And then you'll see after that in parentheses, power of attorney, quitclaim deed, and living trust. And of course, trustee and power of attorney are both relationships under Nevada law that give rise to fiduciary duties. So the presumption would apply here according, again, to the express allegations of the complaint. Now looking at the Rule 9b particularity standard, opposing counsel argues that this was not satisfied. This couldn't be further from the truth, Your Honor. Mary was unduly influenced, as already stated, to execute the quitclaim deed, the power of attorney, and living trust. All of these exhibits are mentioned in the complaint, and they're incorporated by reference and attached as exhibits. Excuse me, they are exhibits to the complaint, and they are incorporated by reference. Those exhibits
Mr.
include...
Mr. Meyer, I have a brief question for you. So what level of specificity as to time, place, and nature of the fraud is required to satisfy 9B? And can that specificity requirement be met solely by attaching documents to the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. To my knowledge, it is specifications of the exact time would consist of the dates would be sufficient and that the documents can be incorporated by reference and will be treated the same as allegations incorporated into the complaint. So the level of granularity.
Is it sufficient? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. So to your point, Your Honor, the level of granularity, the precise level of granularity, I'm not certain, but I know that the dates and the locations, for example, are required in that, for example, the quitclaim deed includes the county of Washoe recorder, so we know the place. But I do believe, Your Honor, that according to the authority, you can incorporate these documents by reference into the complaint, and that would be sufficient.
Is it enough that we know that the dates of the relevant document signings, or do we have to know the dates that the undue influence was exerted?
So I would submit, Your Honor, that both are satisfied here because she was unduly influenced to submit the quitclaim deed, to execute the quitclaim deed. So the dates that are on those documents would be the date on which the undue influence occurred.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. So again, the 9B standard is satisfied by the documents that are incorporated by reference. But unless Your Honors wanted to talk about another claim in particular, I'm going to move on to the second point. I will note that opposing counsel argues that because my client cited the criminal statutes for elder abuse, that is...
Mr. Meyer,
yes, Judge.
Before you move on, regarding the transfer of the property, the complaint referred to NRS 155097, which is in the transfer section of the NRS and talks about undue influence. However, on appeal, that statute is not specifically named. So are you also attempting to resurrect a claim under 155 that this transfer was by undue influence and use that statute?
No, Your Honor, not necessarily that statute. So to Your Honor's point, yes, the statute was cited. However, under the case of Harris, the precise actual statutory number, NRS, whatever have you, Your Honor, is not necessary in order for her to properly state a claim. So here, her claim for the setting aside of the quitclaim deed does not depend upon the citation to that statute. And I can give you the citation to that case if you would like, Your Honor.
Yes, please.
So that is the Harris case, and that is at 510 P3rd 802 at 807, and it talks about a Nevada Department of Corrections regulation that was not specifically stated in the complaint, but was able to be relied upon in order to meet the notice pleading standard.
All right, go ahead.
Turning to the second issue, Your Honors. The district court plainly erred by dismissing Ms. Melton's complaint with prejudice without conducting the analysis required for imposing case-concluding sanctions under the case of Young. In this court's decision in Ebbe versus Johnston Law Office, the district court dismissed all claims based upon 12b-5 but one for malpractice. The court then ordered a more definite statement, and then when the plaintiff refiled the amended complaint, the plaintiff attempted to substitute a jailhouse lawyer. Now, on appeal, this court reversed, finding that the district court plainly erred by dismissing with prejudice without applying the Young factors. This court noted that although the Young concerned discovery sanctions, it also applies, quote, in situations in which a court dismisses a case terminating sanction in response to a party's conduct in litigation. This court also described the district court's dismissal as, quote, a case concluding sanction for Ebbe's failure to comply with a court order, end quote. Here, as in Ebby, Your Honor, the dismissal with prejudice is an order that basically goes down the list of all of my client's alleged litigation misconduct. It goes through the history, then it describes the first order, which directed Ms. Melton to, quote, clearly identify the factual basis for each claim, which sounds in an order for a more definite statement, much like at what was at issue in Ebby. Then the court proceeds to discuss
Mr.
how...
Mr. Meyer, let me interrupt you just for a minute. So are you saying that the first complaint or the first petition should never have been dismissed?
Yes, correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Because appellant was given the opportunity, the court did give the appellant an opportunity to amend the pleading or the petition, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But it is our position But it is our position that the first order should not have been issued in the first place because the 12B5 standard was satisfied. But yes, to Your Honor's point, she was given an opportunity to amend. And if Your Honor is interested in discussing the propriety of whether or not the amendment was enough to justify a dismissal with prejudice, that would actually be an analysis for the Young factors, which were not applied here. And so that's the issue we have, Your Honor, is under the Ebby case, this court found that those factors need to apply if we're going to get into the weeds of my client's relative culpability for not complying with a previous order, for example. In that same vein, Your Honor, go ahead. I apologize.
No, I just said thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. So in that same vein, Your Honor, the district court granted Ms. Lawson's objection to Ms. Melton's refiled complaint. It wasn't another motion to dismiss. It was a grant of an objection that was also, that the order also did. And that objection requested to strike, deny, or dismiss my client's amended pleading. This is litigation conduct. This is what this court recognized in Ebby required a Young factors analysis. Finally, this court or the district court in its dismissal with prejudice stated, quote, as a result of plaintiff petitioner's several failures to comply, the failure to timely amend, and the lack of a cogent statement of the purported claims for relief, defendant's motion to dismiss is granted. So here, Your Honor, it is very clear that litigation conduct is what was at issue. And even though this court, actually, I want to note, this court pointed out itself that it wasn't very clear what the district court's reasoning was in Ebby for dismissing the complaint, but what was dispositive was the fact that there was not a Young analysis applied. And I just want to note one more thing, Your Honor, which is that opposing counsel alludes to this language of lack of a cogent statement in that list. Cogency does not sound in the 12B5 standard. This is actually referencing the previous order. It is saying that you did not comply with me asking you or the court asking you to more definitely state your allegations. And unless Your Honors have further questions, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. O'Rourke?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Patrick O'Rourke for Respondent Stephanie Lawson. May it please the Court. So this case is certainly not a case where the appellate's pro se status has been held against her, if anything, but she's been given more opportunities than I've ever seen to bring a claim. She started this process by bringing a claim in federal district court for the District of Northern Nevada, which was dismissed because she cited largely criminal statutes and framed her complaint in a way that was indecipherable.
Mr. O'Rourke, the reply brief criticized you for arguing about proceedings outside of the record here. We asked
Certainly.
About the probate because that's part of this case, but any other cases really aren't.
Certainly. No, just for a brief timeline of what Ms. Lawson has gone through here. And then they brought the probate action, which was also dismissed. And there are numerous untrue allegations in the appeal itself that claim that there were findings made by the probate court, that these documents were invalid and things like that, which findings were never made by the probate court. And there was no will contest that was upheld. None of that is pending. So the special administration is open so that this action can continue, but solely for that purpose, just for the court's information. Okay.
So there is a special administration, and Ms. Melton is the administrator?
That is correct, and I believe the court is correct that Ms. Melton does not have any individual standing to bring these claims. She only has standing on behalf of Ms. Melton's estate under NRS 41-100. But after the probate court dismissed the claim, she brought the claims again in civil court in the Second Judicial District for numerous statutes. And I mean, really the standard is that Ms. Lawson needs to be on notice of what claims she needs to defend against and what the damages sought are, what the underlying factual allegations are. And that's...
Well, Mr. O'Rourke, don't you believe that the documents that were attached to the complaint give some factual information to support any type of claim that, or one of the claims at least, that the appellant has raised?
There's some sparse information, but not sufficient. The undue influence claim has been held to be a fraud claim, and so it requires a heightened pleading standard on our NRCP 9, where you need to further allege the time, the place, the facts that lead to the allegations, that support the allegations. And she completely failed to do that by simply attaching some documents. She doesn't allege where they were drafted, why she thinks that they were drafted by Ms. Lawson, how she overcame her free will, how she inserted. There's really nothing there other than conclusory statements. And
there are some claims that might sound in negligence versus intentional tort or fraud, aren't there?
There are, but then she doesn't allege any duty of care that arose. She says that Ms. Lawson proclaimed herself as a caregiver, but she doesn't say how or where or what sort of proclamation as a caregiver attaches a legal duty to care for someone. So Ms. Lawson never had any duty to care for her neighbor, Mary Melton. She was helping her out of the goodness of her heart as much as she could, but she was never a legal caregiver. She never was an agent under an advanced healthcare directive. There was no healthcare power of attorney, if any of these allegations allege. She's simply saying that some duty should be imputed, and the statute is very clear that there needs to be a formal duty arising, such as patient advocate, doctor, medical provider, and she alleges a lot of these criminal allegations that apply, for example, to physicians who negligently care for a patient who is under their treatment, and those are really the extent of the allegations made in the petition there.
So, Ms.
Lawson signed a power of attorney, did she not?
That was a financial power of attorney, and it did not grant any medical powers. It didn't include any duty to provide medical care. It doesn't mention medical care or health care in any capacity. And it was
doesn't that establish some type of fiduciary relationship?
No duty of care where negligence to provide proper medical care would arise. And further, it doesn't allege that...
Yes, sir. Take the medical care out of it. Does it establish some type of duty between the decedent and Ms. Lawson, at least as it relates to financial matters?
It does in terms of the use of the power of attorney, which they don't allege that Ms. Lawson ever actually used the power of attorney. They allege that it was executed, but Ms. Lawson didn't take any actions under the power of attorney. There are numerous allegations about a living trust in there as well, but as far as I could tell, the living trust was never funded and it didn't own any assets. So I don't know necessarily the relevance of the living trust either. The probate court couldn't find any probate assets worth discussing.
Mr. O'Rourke, the living trust itself lists Stephanie Lawson as trustee in Article 16, incapacity. If the grantor becomes incapacitated, the trustee shall distribute such amounts of the income and principal of the trust for the comfort, health, support, and maintenance, and any additional care needed. I mean, that seems to be imposing a duty on her to care for Ms. Melton, and that document was attached to the complaint, was it not?
It was to provide income and financial support, but the trust never became the owner of any assets. So the trust didn't own any real property. It didn't own any personal property. It didn't own any bank accounts. It was basically just an empty shell.
Shouldn't those be issues to be resolved? You know, like, shouldn't there have been discovery conducted? I mean, did you present in your motion to dismiss documents proving that the trust wasn't funded?
Ms. Melton remains the special administrator of the estate, and the court urged her numerous times to gather documents to provide some form of evidence or cogent allegations that anything below board occurred or was done by Ms. Lawson, and she was never able to obtain any records of anything that was done with any shred of impropriety by Ms. Lawson. That doesn't impose a duty on her to physically go to Ms. Melton's home and provide medical care to her.
So, Mr. O'Rourke,
I would ask, in this case, should a relaxed standard of care plea or standard of pleading apply under Rocker versus KPMG, since the allegation is that Melton was allegedly kept away from her mother's home and couldn't witness most of the direct interactions between her mother and Lawson?
No, I mean, they don't really allege how any of that actually happened. It's just conclusory statements.
Right, and I guess my question is, how could she possibly have alleged the specifics when she's telling the court in her filing that she was kept away? She was trespassed every time she tried to see her mother. She had no access to her mother because of the allegation that Ms. Lawson kept her mother away from her.
Those type of allegations were addressed in Warren v. Fox Family Worldwide, which was a Ninth Circuit case interpreting an analogous federal statute. It's 328 F3rd 1136, and it applies not to the fraud standard of pleading, but just to the regular notice pleading standard, and it holds that a court does not assume the truth of conclusions merely because the claimant casts them in the form of factual allegations. And that's largely the essence of Ms. Melton's whole petition. It's just factual conclusions with no supporting allegations, no plausible claims as to how the elements of any of her claims are supported. She doesn't really frame out her complaint in any understandable way. I was kind of going to go through her timeline here. So she filed, and we moved to dismiss for failure to state a claim that the court or the parties could understand. And she was given 30 days leave to amend her petition. She filed a motion opposing the motion to dismiss after that, which was stricken. And then she was given another 10 days to refile. She filed a motion, again, opposing the dismissal. And then she filed a motion to amend. So she got three chances to basically file an amended complaint before the district court. And Judge Breslow really tried to give her additional deference and a more of a relaxed standard, just trying to figure out what she was really seeking. And when you really read through the complaint, it's just indecipherable what allegations we really need to defend. At the end of the day, there's numerous criminal allegations. They allege allegations that apply to physicians. There's slander. There's libel. There's a whole exhibit full of transcribed text messages that just go on and on, and it lists a text message, and then it says slander, it lists another one, and it says libel.
But Mr. O'Rourke, the district court did not address the attachments to her petition or her subsequent documents she submitted, the declarations, affidavits. None of that was addressed, and it was just a summarily dismissal.
The district court granted our motion to dismiss, and we referenced all those, and they granted our motion as filed. So essentially they agreed with our motion to dismiss that these attachments, this conglomeration of documents that were assembled by Ms. Melton did not put Ms. Lawson in a position where she knows, okay, I need to attack this element of this claim. I need to defend against this element of this claim.
But not a single one needed to be individually addressed. They could all be lumped together as meaningless, including declarations and affidavits, not just the documents.
Well, we went through each of them in our motion to dismiss, and the court essentially just granted our motion as written.
Why was there a motion to dismiss at the outset instead of the motion for a more particular statement?
We had
and second to that, how does the court dismiss it without prejudice if there was no claim to be brought? So don't you have to go through the particular statement first?
In this case, it was just so inadequate that we moved to dismiss, and there's no legal requirement to file for a more definite statement first, but the court gave her additional deference and allowed her leave to amend, as is relatively common in the district court, where, especially with a pro se litigant, if their complaint is fatally deficient, She was given an additional 30 days to actually plead something that we could understand, and the judge even gave her some guidance in the right direction, saying this is exactly what we need to see that would be a complaint that could be actionable in court.
Have you seen the Droege opinion from this court that talks about notice pleading and that the complaining party does not have to specifically identify causes of action, but only has to allege facts that could fit into a cause of action?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I just, at the end of the day, they didn't put Ms. Lawson on notice of what causes of action, whether enumerated or not. We're not attacking the format of her pleadings or the headings or anything like that. We're simply saying, at the end of the day, if I go through each complaint that I can, or each cause of action that I can decipher from the facts, from the attached documents, from the declarations and things like that, I still can't come up with a list of claims to defend that have been properly pleaded. There wasn't a single one that actually could withstand a motion to dismiss at the end of the analysis there.
So there weren't facts of a single claim.
Not as pleaded by Ms. Melton after...
I mean, this complaint has 100 times more than most complaints have.
And it was a sixth attempt at that after the first three rounds, and I don't think
it's
after
just,
that...
It's just not organized the way that a lawyer would do it. It's sort of random, but it does allege a bunch of facts, all these declarations, affidavits, and other documents.
It alleges a lot of conclusory statements, but it's really sparse on actual facts. There aren't really any underlying factual allegations. There's just a plethora of conclusory statements that are pleaded as factual allegations without any underlying support.
Well, it's a complaint. I mean, Judge Westbrook already asked about it. Don't you have to have discovery to find out what the underlying support is?
Well, not for fraud claims under NRCP 9. And
what about the rest? They just put the fraud to the side.
We were trying to figure out what the rest were. I mean, there's criminal negligence, there's slander, there's criminal duty of a physician to care for a patient. I mean, she cites a lot of actual statutes in there. NRS 199-120, she's accusing Ms. Lawson of perjury. 200-571, criminal harassment. 250-91, duty of physicians to report criminal abuse. 200-50995, criminal penalties for conspiracy. 200-510, criminal libel, criminal forgery. I mean, the list is just so extensive.
Couldn't the district court have said that then? Everything that alleges a crime is dismissed because you cannot bring that in a civil complaint. Everything else there, is there a fact that will support that particular claim that's left?
There were only two others that we could actually decipher.
Saw the appellant's opening brief. They went through a whole series of claims that are there.
They did, but they didn't show how Ms. Melton had actually satisfied the factual allegations to satisfy each element of any one of those claims. They really essentially tried to rewrite her petition for her at this level, which is really not the proper place. I wish she had gotten counsel below and hopefully was able to organize her allegations a little better.
Maybe the money's gone, and so she can't afford to hire counsel, and your client has the money and could afford to hire counsel.
And I mean, there wasn't really any money to speak of to begin with. We gave her substantial access in the whole probate proceeding. She went out to the property numerous times. She couldn't find anything. We offered to give her everything that was there, and she didn't want to take it. We really tried to cooperate here, and it's I think her intent is really clear. If you look at one of the text messages that she actually attached to one of her pleadings, you know, she says, this property wasn't hers to give. I don't care that she wanted to give it to you. It's mine. And I think that's really the underlying motivation here, is a resentment towards her own mother and a desire to do what she always wanted and not what Mary Melton wanted.
If Ms. Lawson is not the caretaker for Ms. Melton, who passed away, why would she be the beneficiary of everything in the estate of Ms. Melton?
She was a dear friend, and we actually talked to numerous of her other relatives. We talked to Ms. Melton's son, her grandson, her sisters, and they all told her that they didn't want this property. So we really tried to, Ms. Lawson tried to say, give it to anyone but me, and every single other relative declined, and she didn't want to give it to Ms. Melton or Catherine, because she had stolen from her.
So I assume then you submitted a declaration from your client that laid that out, their relationship and how she was such a dear friend.
We didn't really have to get that far because we didn't know what allegations we were
discovery
defending.
Discovery has there.
No, and I mean, Ms. Melton, before she died, recorded a 30-minute video describing why she did all this with witnesses. She, her sister was willing to fly in and testify. I mean, it's just an incredible expense for Ms. Lawson to bear,
sounds
really
like,
for no reason.
Sounds like a trial. Go ahead. Sorry, Chief Judge Baldwin.
Oh, that's okay. We're 2 minutes over. So, Mr. O'Rourke, if you want to just make a concluding remark.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on that dismissal as a sanction argument, because there's never been an example where a dismissal for failure to state a claim has been considered a dismissal as a sanction for litigation misconduct. And I think that's just much too far of a stretch of the case law on that issue to say that a dismissal for failure to comply with a essentially a dismissal without prejudice, allowing leave to amend to state a claim upon which relief could be granted, is a an element of misconduct. It's just, you failed to state a claim once, you failed to state a claim a second time and a third time and a fourth time, and so we can't move forward because we don't know what claims you're bringing. It's not, you know, you hid evidence, you lied, you every site that they make on the issue is for actual misconduct, not failure to plead something that anyone understands.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two brief points on rebuttal. First, I'd like to point out that everything opposing counsel just mentioned about how many times they've had to come back to court, how many times they've had to respond to my client's pleadings, are all pertinent to the Young factors which were not applied. That itself is reversible error alone under the Ebbe case. Now, look at what opposing counsel just did. The same platitudes and the same disputes of facts that we saw in the motion to dismiss. They are making arguments that are based upon allegations that are not there. We are at the pleading stage. These are disputes of fact. These platitudes of you didn't meet the standard, you didn't state things specifically. Your Honors, the exact phrases, the complaints, the claims that he alleges are not decipherable and they are specifically labeled under, quote, elder abuse, quote, breach of fiduciary duties. All of those are there. As a matter of fact, to give you an example, he just discussed how, no, this is not a power of attorney that has to do with the general sense. It is a power of attorney in the financial sense. They are arguing disputes of fact at the motion to dismiss, the answering brief, and now. This is all, as Judge Westbrook pointed out, a good reason to go to discovery. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that you reverse the district court.
Thank you very much.